Penguin Random House Audio presents Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. Read for you by Kirby Hayborn, with a foreword and afterword read by Morgan Freeman. Note to listeners, Ishmael is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, events, and incidents are the products of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously. Any resemblance to actual persons living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.
For Rennie. Foreword. Thousands of readers have told me that Ishmael changed their lives. It began, however, by changing mine. It began this way in the early 60s, long before that book was even imagined, much less written. On graduating from Loyola University of Chicago in 1956, I was very lucky to get a job of any kind that wasn't pushing a broom or flipping burgers, and very, very lucky indeed to get a job in publishing at the American People's Encyclopedia. It wasn't a very impressive job, but it was an important one nonetheless. I was the sole cut-line writer, producing captions for diagrams, illustrations, and photos of people, places, works of art, and so on. Almost all of these were to be, when typeset, exactly three lines flush right and left. This made for very tricky work, since at that time it had to be done using a tool, a typewriter, that produced a lowercase I and a capital W that were exactly the same width. I learned, had to learn, how to express the same general idea in as many ways as it took to end up with one that worked out to exactly three lines, 40 to 43 characters long. I very quickly learned that when putting something into words, you don't have to settle for the first thing you try. There are always going to be dozens of others to try. With Truman Capote, I say, I don't write, I rewrite. Making a long story short, my experience and responsibilities grew steadily over the following years. On the fifth of those, the editor-in-chief retired. This meant that the managing editor, Ruth Hunt, advanced to take his place. Frances Squibb, head of the Biography and Fine Arts Department, advanced to take her place, and I advanced to take his place and began earning the princely sum of $125 a week. The cut-line writer at that time was Harvey Arden, who later became an author in his own right of Wisdom Keepers, Meetings with Native American Spiritual Elders, and others. Frances, the best editor I was ever to know, was a great and severe teacher, and nothing passed his desk to reach the desk of the editor-in-chief that didn't make sense. Making sense may sound like a rather low standard, but it was a very high one when applied by Frances. To give him an article in which one sentence fell short was to be loudly summoned to his desk in the middle of the room and given a sarcastic scolding that would leave any department head gnashing his teeth, not because Francis was wrong, but because he was so damned right. I learned perforce to demand sense of every word in every article handed to me by one of the writers in my department, or by one of the outside scholars who contributed articles. Our article on relativity was written by Albert Einstein, and without noticing it, I began to demand sense of everything I knew, which included the received wisdom of our culture. In this regard, two things in particular failed to satisfy me. The first was this. It was universally agreed that human history was basically the same as our history. The history that began about 10,000 years ago with the agricultural revolution. In the 3 million years of human life that came before that, nothing of importance had occurred, except perhaps the domestication of fire and the invention of the wheel. The lives lived during that time were of no interest or importance, were in fact completely meaningless and undeserving of any attention. This made no sense to me. That 150,000 generations of humans could live and go down to death with nothing in their heads or lives worth knowing was inconceivable. So I began looking, a thing that was not as easy to do then as it is today, when a Google search on Homo habilis tools delivers more than 130,000 results in under a second. My connection to the encyclopedia got me into the Newberry Library, Chicago's exclusive, non-public and non-lending, scholars and researchers library. But the card catalog of that time may have pointed to perhaps 20 books that might, but only might, have something to say about tools known to have been used by Homo habilis, and even this would have taken many hours to discover. The second of the two things that failed to satisfy me was the inexplicable acceptance that our culture awards to three crucial stories in Genesis. I call them crucial because they're all but universally recognized and taken seriously by the people of our culture. The first of these is familiar to everyone everywhere, the story of Adam's fall in the Garden of Eden. It's universally known, even though it fails in fundamental ways to make sense. It is said, Genesis chapter 2, verses 15 through 18, that the first man and woman might eat the fruit of any tree in the garden except one that had been expressly forbidden, the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Biblical notes are silent as to why it should have been forbidden. The consensus among commentators is fundamentally that God needed to forbid Adam and Eve something to test their loyalty. So he made it the fruit of this one tree, which might just as well have been the tree of knowledge of circles and squares. Perhaps the knowledge of good and evil just sounded more grave and impressive. The people of our culture were confident that it has no real or profound meaning because, in fact, every one of us has this knowledge. It's so elementary that our children learn it at an early age, and it's so fundamental to the human mind that in U.S. courts, its absence in a person can be put forward as proof of insanity. Therefore, forbidding this fruit to Adam and Eve simply makes no sense at all, though the tempter serpent seemed to think that it does. He explained that God knows that as soon as you eat it, your eyes will be opened and you will be like gods, knowing both good and evil. Genesis chapter 3, verse 5. But none of us pay any attention to this wicked creature's notions. Why would we? Expelled from the garden, where food was free for the taking, Adam was compelled, cursed, to become an agriculturalist. Both these things contradict the common understandings of our culture. To begin with, we know that knowledge of good and evil is an innocent and perfectly fine thing to have. So Adam's sin was no sin at all. And since the attainment of agriculture was without the slightest doubt humanity's greatest blessing, the curse laid upon Adam was no curse at all. The two stories about brothers Cain and Abel are similarly mystifying. The two brothers enter Genesis when each presents his special gift to God, Cain's being the product of tilling the soil, perhaps a basket of wheat, Abel's being the product of herding, perhaps a lamb. God looks favorably on Abel's gift but rejects Cain's. His actions here as apparently arbitrary as those taken by him in the Garden of Eden. Just as we know that agriculture is a blessing, not a curse, we know that the crop of a farmer is just as worthy as the crop of a herder. Senseless story elements like these are accepted everywhere in our culture without the least resistance, as though God's actions are not really expected to make sense. in the...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?